winning is just as important on the prep level, unfortunately. It's win or look for another job, in most cases. I've often thought that prep athletics are being spoiled by this must-win approach. Ruined, because the fun of competing is being squeezed out of existence, replaced by relentless pressure to succeed. Then along comes L.C. Sweet, and his team, without coaching, without haranguing, without discipline, is successful. Most of the coaching fraternity regards Sweet as a freak. But there is no denying that the Macon players are relaxed, having fun, having a ball, instead of being uptight about losing. Is having fun so unorthodox in high school athletics? Do coaches have to be a combination of Vince Lombardi and General Patton? Sweet doesn't think so. I'll back him up. How to prepare for the biggest morning of your life? That was the question that faced the Ironman on Thursday night. In one room, Henneberry and a half dozen others huddled around the color TV and watched as Cubs ace Ken Holtzman mowed down Cincinnati Reds batters. Others played games of pitch, the unofficial card game of Macon. Throughout, one boy was conspicuously absent. Earlier in the evening, Schartzer had been spotted in the lobby with Mark Miller, briefly conferring with a few female Macon students. But now he was nowhere to be found. No one went looking for him, though, as Steve had asked to be left alone during the tournament. Down one of the long halls, he lay on his bed, staring up at the white perforated ceiling tiles. Tonight, there was no asthma. His hand throbbed, but he didn't think about that either. Instead, Schartzer thought about how many people were driving up from Macon, and how they were all counting on him. He thought about how far the team had come, and how important it was for him to lead them now. He thought about how, as he later said, "No one elected me to carry the flag, but I took the damn thing and wasn't going to fall on it." 18. The drums. The Macon High students couldn't believe it. "School closed today," read the sign on the front of Macon High. It was like having a snow day in June. Not that any of the kids planned on goofing around. The student bus left the parking lot for Peoria at 6:30 a.m., and it was joined over the course of the morning by enough cars to fill three parking lots around Minon Field. Flags fluttered from windows and pennants twirled. One Macon fan used duct tape to plaster the side of his white sedan with, "Number one Macon Ironman, yeah!" Jane Metzger was one of the students on the school bus, and she remembers the giddy excitement of the morning. For 2 hours, Tim Cook, the diminutive former junior high baseball coach, led a series of Ironman cheers. In the back, a student had turned a transistor radio to WLSAM 890 out of Chicago. At one point, the DJ, Larry Lujak, began talking about the state baseball finals and mentioned that some tiny school from Macon had made it. Lujak then cracked that he'd never heard of Macon and had no idea where it was. For Metzger, it was one of the first times she realized just how small her town was. 3 hours north in Chicago, hundreds of thousands of people awoke and opened their Tribune to see that same small town on the front of the sports page. Above a story reading, "Top two draft choices sign bear contracts," and another about the Cubs with a headline, "Santo has sympathy for bench," ran a banner headline, "Lane Tech wins state opener, 2-1. Just below in large letters it read, "Macon to provide next test." Friday morning dawned hot and muggy. Sweet rose not long after sunrise, after spending part of the previous night at the bar talking with Jeannie about ways to keep the team loose. Sweet was proud of how independent the boys had become. He wanted them to forge their own identity, to realize the world wasn't that big, and that Macon wasn't that small. Now, as the Ironmen were poised to make another tournament run, he wanted outsiders to see the team as self-sufficient, to give the boys credit for their success, not the coach or some program. Most of all, he wanted the boys to keep it all in perspective. So far, his strategy had worked. His stunt with the press had gone over as well as he could have hoped, and his decision to shelter the team at Jumer's was also paying off. Now, he'd restricted all access. He didn't want the boys overthinking the game. He just wanted them to play. It was time for one final gambit. He gathered the Iron Men at breakfast in the hotel restaurant. The boys looked up, wondering if Sweet had prepared a speech. Instead, he looked them over and, in a very serious voice, said, "Guys, now you've heard that these Lane Tech guys are just like us. They put their pants on one leg at a time." Sweet paused and scanned the room again. "Well, they're not. They jump into them 2 feet at a time." At one end of the table, Jeff Glahn watched his teammates' reactions, the way they began giggling, almost against their will. He'd heard Sweet refer to himself as a sponsor before, but Glahn saw his coach as more of a psychologist. He'd never had a teacher or coach who understood moods and motivations like Sweet. What Sweet possessed, Glahn would later realize, was what people called emotional intelligence. After breakfast, Jack Henneberry approached. After asking Sweet's permission, he walked off to the side of the room with his son. Looking John in the eye, Jack told him how it would be asking too much to win this game. He told him how the Iron Men had had a great season, how John had had a great season, and how he was so proud of him for that Bloomington game. Then he told him that it was okay. No one expected him to win this one. Then Jack Henneberry pulled out a crumpled piece of paper and handed it to his son. "But this might help," he said. By 8:15 a.m., when the Macon bus left for Minen Field, the players were already sweating. Though warm on Thursday, it had been pleasant enough, nearly perfect baseball weather. Now, the heat hung like a wet blanket over Peoria, as if the whole river town awoke to find the banks had overflowed and taken to the air. As the bus pulled up, the boys were shocked to see spectators already lining the bleachers. By 9:15, they overflowed onto the grass. One Lane Tech fan with sunglasses and prodigious mutton chops had brought a large snare drum. You could hear the bang, bang, bang from a quarter of a mile away. The Lane Tech contingent was impressive, but paled in comparison to the crowd on the other side of the diamond. There had never been, and likely never will be, a make-and-away crowd like this one. As he looked around, Henneberry recognized one face after another. Britton, McClard, Pelker, Burns, the entire Otta extended clan. There was Jane Metzger and Diane Tomlinson, screaming like the cheerleaders they were during basketball and football season. Around them swarmed a horde of students already chanting for the Iron Men, and cheers led by a handsome, dark-haired senior named Cliff Brown, who stood waving a large purple Iron Men flag. There were kids from Blue Mound and kids from Mauquia, relatives from Decatur and Champaign. There were babies in sun hats and mothers in big dark glasses fanning themselves. Little boys ran in circles behind the bleachers. Others, like Scott Taylor, sat rapt, watching. Henneberry tried to count all the fans, but could only guess at their number. 1,000? 2,000? One thing was sure. Of the 1,200 residents of Macon, the vast majority were in Peoria on this day. Farther down, the scouts huddled with their arms crossed, whispering to each other. Henneberry had never seen so many at a game. There was one in a Kansas City Royals shirt and another with a Yankees hat. Over to the side, he recognized Itchy Jones, the coach at Southern Illinois, the biggest baseball power in the state. Henneberry was supposed to be warming up, but he couldn't help himself. He had to take it all in for a minute. Either way, win or lose, he knew this was the last game of his high school career. If Macon won, Schartzer would pitch the title game. Hennebery thought about how crazy and wonderful it was that on the last day of his athletic career, he got to pitch for a chance to reach the state championship. He tried to soak up the moment, to freeze time, to scan the crowd and imprint each face into his memory. Then, before he took his first throw, he pulled the small yellow piece of notepad paper from his back pocket one last time. John knew his father lacked traditional baseball training, but Jack had seen enough of his son's games to know the type of hitters he could and couldn't get out. So while the other parents had headed off to celebrate the previous afternoon, ecstatic just to have won one game, Jack had stuck around to watch Lane Tech. Immediately, he'd noticed one player, the kid with a big black bat, as he described him, Mark Ronkowitz. "He can really hurt us," Jack scribbled in a notebook. "Don't even pitch to him." He wrote the same thing about John Rockwell, the leadoff hitter who tagged the monster shot on the opening day of the tournament. The best piece of advice, though, was one of the last things Jack said before he handed his son the piece of paper. "Son," Jack had said, "they really look terrible against the pitcher's curveball in the first game. Now, this guy's a better pitcher than you are, but when he went to his slow curve, they looked sick." And here he'd placed his hand on John's shoulder and smiled. "And you have a better slow curveball than he does." Nearby, Joe Cook and Bob Falstrom stood and watched, incredulous. Cook had seen Schartzer pitch a number of times, but neither of the men had seen Hennebery in person. Now, as Hennebery sent a succession of floaters toward Dean Otta during warm-ups, Cook couldn't believe what he was seeing. This was Hennebery? The kid couldn't break a window pane. He was, as Cook remembers, just sort of lobbing it in there. On the other side of the diamond, Ronkowitz was also warming up. Like everyone on Lane Tech, he sported a bright green and gold uniform, and he looked, as Cook remembers, like he just came out of a showroom. Tall and muscular with a strong chin, Ronkowitz threw one fastball after another, popping the mitt on each. Presently, Falstrom turned to Cook. "Well, this doesn't look like much of a game." Cook had to agree with him. "This is going to be a disaster," he thought. "Why are we even up here?" As the first pitch neared, the two men headed to the small press box behind the backstop. It was farther from the field than either was accustomed to. Whereas at most fields in central Illinois, the backstop was only 15 feet or so behind home plate, at Minen Field, it was closer to 60. As always, Cook kept score. Quickly, he scribbled down the lineups. Macon. Mark Miller, second base. Dale Otta, shortstop. Steve Schartzer, third base. Stu Arnold, center field. Dean Otta, catcher. David Wells, left field. Jeff Glenn, first base. Brian Snitker, right field. John Hennebery, pitcher. Lane Tech. John Rockwell, second base. Jim Owanski, first base. Jim Flamang, left field. Mark Ronkowitz, pitcher. Walt Kreikluek, catcher. Richie Coleman, right field. Dale Wyateka, third base. Rick Wacholder, shortstop. Nick Ocheruk, center field. When he finished, Cook checked his scorebook. For some reason, Lane had inserted its backup catcher, Kreikluek, into the lineup rather than the usual starter. At the time, Cook didn't think much of it. All that preparation, all those dreams, and this is what happens? At 9:30, the state semifinal began, and the Iron Men promptly forgot how to hit. For three innings, all the Macon boys did was go down swinging. Working from a windup to the sound of the drums going bang, 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 Ronkowitz blew away one batter after another, striking out six straight Iron Men at one point through a combination of fastballs, sliders, curveballs, and forkballs. For the season, his record stood at 10-1, with 104 strikes in 70 innings. That he'd nearly gone his entire high school career without pitching was hard to believe. As it was, only when a scout saw Ronkowitz whiffing batters during a summer semi-pro league and mentioned this fact to Papsiak did the old coach get the idea that maybe he, too, should put the kid on the mound. As for Henneberry, he took the mound as concerned as ever about walking the first batter. What's more, that batter was Rockwell, and Henneberry remembered all too well what he did to the first pitch in the quarterfinal game. So Henneberry rocked, unwound, and looped in a curve that appeared headed right for Rockwell's head. Acting on instinct, Rockwell took cover. He was sitting in the dirt on his butt when the umpire said, "Strike!" Inside, Henneberry felt a prickle of excitement. "I've got my good stuff." Of course, the good stuff only worked if his defense backed him up. And in the second inning, the Iron Men ran into trouble. A pair of errors was followed by a sacrifice fly to give Tech a 1-0 lead. Bang, 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 went the drum. As the Macon players jogged back to the bench, Sweet stood up to meet them. But rather than ripping into the boys after the errors and telling them to get their heads in the game, he smiled. "All right, hand me your gloves. I'm going to have Sammy here sew up the holes in between innings." Then he patted Mark Miller on the back. "Now I think we've let this big kid get his fill of strikeouts for the day. How about a hit?" Next to the bleachers, a handful of the coaches from the other teams in the tournament watched in disbelief. Who was this guy? For 2 days they'd read about Sweet, with his peace signs and hippy-dippy approach to the game, and they were sick of it. When Charles Chamberlain, the AP reporter, ambled over between innings, he got an earful. "If Macon wins the state championship," one of the coaches told him, "it will set back Illinois high school baseball 10 years. Another, of course asking to remain anonymous, called Sweet a disgrace to the profession. On the field, the disgrace gathered his players near the bench. "Guys, run if you get on base," he said. "It's awful hot out here, and I think those city boys are having trouble with it. Let's see if they can catch you." Sweet was right about one thing. The weather had become a factor. Though only a little past 10 a.m., the temperature had soared past 90 degrees, and the humidity was extreme. In the field, Lane shortstop Rick Wachholder was already having trouble. He could feel the heat shooting up through his metal spikes, searing the soles of his feet, and he waited as long as possible to head out to the field each inning. Once there, he counted the seconds until he could get back to the bench, where the Lane coaches had a cooler filled with cool, wet towels which the Lane players draped over their heads between innings. Schartzer looked over and was no longer envious of those thick, pretty uniforms. It wasn't much better in the stands. The heat was so intense that the generator providing power for the hot dog stand had broken down before the end of the first inning. This being the age before sunscreen and bottled water, the fans had no choice but to pull their hats down and sweat it out. Metzger's hair had long ago shot out into a halo of frizz, and one man from Macon named Marvin Lash ended up going to the hospital with heat stroke. Superfan Cliff Brown had doffed his shirt and now wore only a wide-brimmed hat, sunglasses, jeans, and a bandana tied around his neck. Around him, other Macon boys followed suit, shifting restlessly, waiting for some reason to cheer. In the top of the fourth, Dale Otta finally gave it to them. Once again, as he'd done against Mark Carley earlier in the playoffs, Otta broke the pitcher's spell. This time it was a single to center to halt the string of 6 shutouts. Once on first, Otta didn't hesitate. It was time to test the backup catcher's arm. Moments later, he was at second. With a Macon crowd roaring, the rally continued. 4 hits and another stolen base later, Macon held a 2-1 lead. Now it was up to Henneberry to hold the line, and for 3 more innings, he worked his magic. Just as Jack Henneberry had surmised, the lane players continued to hack away at fluttering curves in the dirt. Each time they swung at one, Henneberry figured he should throw another in the same spot. By the fifth inning, Lane's assistant coaches were yelling, "Take some pitches!" Still, Henneberry was concerned. His pitches were certainly breaking, but he didn't feel like he had great control. If Lane just made him throw strikes, it could get